You're listening to the Rabbit Room Podcast. For more information, visit rabbitroom.com. This is Drew Miller, and today I share with you the second half of a discussion I had recently with Danny Bryant, pastor of St. Mary of Bethany Anglican Parish, and Steve Guthrie, professor of religion and the arts at Belmont University. Our discussion centered around the question, can we call the crucifixion beautiful? When the three of us first convened, we came to the conclusion that we have much to learn by answering yes as well as no. In this portion of our discussion, we explore contemporary equivalents of ancient Roman crucifixion as an expression of political power, as well as God's fondness of subverting human power plays. You'll notice throughout our conversation that we reference several books and poems. I have compiled these references at the end of this episode in case you're interested in some further research. It is my hope that this discussion can shed light on the significance of Jesus' death as we anticipate his resurrection Easter morning. Enjoy and thanks for listening. I love this idea that the crucifixion as a method of execution is something we thought of, and the notion that God would take something that we conceived in our own poverty, in our own disease, and transfigure it into the single most reverenced symbol of human history, maybe. You know, I mean, that's a big claim, but I'm not sure that
I think it is
refuted. I mean, that to me, When I think about that, something very deep within me says, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's your affirmation.
Back to play. I mean,
absolutely.
That is a turn of phrase if there ever was one.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Like, this symbol of telling the world that you are in control, so don't mess with us, is the thing I'll show you that you're actually not in control through. There's something very playful in that, but playful does seem to, in our definition of play,
right,
trivialize it. But it's so beautiful, and like, it is, like, I think it's Buechner who talks about the gospel is like a good joke. If you don't get it, something is lost in trying to explain it to you. And that's something that sort of either grabs us or it doesn't.
I think it's worth asking ourselves, at the risk of being a little too forward and maybe ascribing meaning to and significance to things, that it's worth asking what tools we have conceived in our society versus ancient Rome that God is doing the same things with. And I'm not very familiar with asking that question. I don't know if I've ever really, truly asked it and try to find an answer or some answers to it. But I think it's a really helpful, almost discipline to try to apply that logic to now and see if we can glimpse the same activity from God in the world we live in the culture that we are swimming in, because awareness is everything, right? And once we develop that awareness and see, oh, this is just another phony human conception that's being overturned as we speak for the glory of God, that's kind of an awakening that can be pretty powerful in a life. So I don't know if you guys have any, it doesn't have to be a method of execution. It can be, but I mean, take that, you know, it can be a method of execution, maybe just not literally, you know. I know that people say, especially when they're, you know, talking about getting rid of the death penalty, they'll I've heard the illustration of the electric chair being the modern day cross. And that's jarring to me to think of Jesus on the electric chair. And I'm sure that some artist has depicted that in a way that is meant to wake us from our slumber. But I mean, you can think of method of execution figuratively as well. You can run that route and think of how, I don't know, the ways that we are numbed and the way that we're dying in sort of a daily sense as well. Any tools that have been conceived to do that, that are also being overturned. So it's a lot of possibility for an answer. I'm now realizing.
Yeah.
So take it however you want.
So what are the instruments of our culture that are used to bring about death that God might use to bring about life? I mean, it would be one way of paraphrasing that. And in a sense, I want to say, well, everything, you know? Mm-hmm. Augustine, you know, talks about sin as disorder to desire. Part of the reason for that is Augustine, for a while, is a Manichaean rather than a Christian. It's because he can't work out how could a good God have created a world with bad things. So the Manichaeans answer that by saying, well, you got good God, bad God, you know? So that solves the problem of evil just like that, man, you know? Puppy dogs, good God, you know? Tornadoes, bad God, you know? Chocolate cake, good God. Asparagus, bad God.
It's like a Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, so, but Augustine says, no, we have to say, if God created everything, that everything is good. But if it's, when it's oriented toward love of neighbor and love of God, it's good. When it's disordered, when it's placed above love of neighbor and love of God, then it becomes distorted. So, I mean, an obvious example to me would be sex. You know, when you look at sex as something which causes all sorts of anxiety and brings about hurt and brokenness in so many lives, and then also is a source of such tremendous healing and joy and life. Augustine would say, you know, it's the same thing, but when it is oriented towards self, when it is consumed for the good of the self, then it becomes hurtful. When it's extended toward others for the good of another, then it becomes a source of life.
I've heard you speak before about a non-competitive ontology versus a perspective where life is a zero-sum game and everything is
right.
conceived of as a competition. And you're reminding me of that. I agree entirely. I also feel the need to make a disclaimer of sorts, where if we're talking about all the good things God created, the things that we create I guess the easiest example for this is technology. Uh-huh. Of any sort, but
podcasts particularly.
Oh, they're so insidious, and you just never realize the evil they're wreaking until it's already done.
Drive-through ashes.
Like drive-through ashes. Yeah, trying to get a really good conversation without face-to-face interaction. Right? Yeah. We're just cheap. That's all we are. But anyway, I feel the need to say that nothing is neutral. You know, it's easy to have the logic of, well, God can use everything for good. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of how we use the things that we're using, whether it is, you know, our smartphones or our cars. I don't know. You can go anywhere with that. But I want to acknowledge that our inventions are not themselves neutral, but are, inextricably tied up with both good and brokenness. And so accounting for that can maybe help us deal with the complexity of trying
to say like, oh, well, this thing is, you know, it just all depends on how you use it, because I do think that things are conceived out of a place of brokenness as well, whether those be tools of human life, or does that make sense?
Let me say too, I don't think Augustine is at all saying that everything is neutral. He wants to say everything is good. Mm-hmm. But similarly to what we were saying before, when you're talking about, it's not that the cross is beautiful, it's that Jesus is beautiful, that it's the desires and the orientation of the heart that engage with the world in a way that that celebrates and lays hold of its goodness or distorts it. But then you're right, yeah. So it does become more complicated if we're talking about human creations. So, you know, is a gun good in itself, bad in itself, or neutral, depending on how you use it? And I agree that there's something that feels a little facile about saying, well, it just depends how you use it. You
know? I think our modern ears hear neutrality pretty easily in the Augustine quote that you were sharing. He's not saying it, but I think that I've come into contact with the sort of the Christian project of taking popular culture and using it for good, and it's really neutral and just depends on how we,
right,
you know. And I think that's kind of
the
mentality I'm trying to correct and bring into the discussion.
I think one of the things that makes it intimidating to try to answer this in this format is the rush to good or bad and the lack of respect for gray area, or where it's like, you know, when I think of the cross and the man-made tool and like the symbol of we are in control, don't question this. And even that comes out of like peace, right? The Pax Romana, like, but it is this false peace. My mind goes to professional sports. Even when you went to competition from Steve's riding, like, it's been fascinating to see Nashville's relationship with our hockey team, which I love and like love to go to games and really enjoy it. But there is such a false peace when your hockey team is doing well. Mm. These, you know, 20-something-year-old kids from Finland and Canada who we gather to watch play and feel like connected to when they do well, and we sing songs there called, like, one of the main songs they did the playoff run last year was called Glorious. And so there's glory and there's awe and there's screaming, but you stop and you sing the national anthem first, and there are soldiers there with guns, and we're at the football game where the planes fly over reminding you, like, in this competition that you're about to take part in, you're safe because of the planes that just flew over. There's a standing ovation at every game for a soldier. So right now, like, some people who might be listening to this, oh, he doesn't value the military. But like, we can't just stop and say like, hey, I'm not safe today because of the military. They are not who help me sleep at night. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful they're there. Like, it's complex, but I think the false safety that we prop up, that was the same thing that was propped up in the crucifixion.
Yeah.
This form of violent control. And I don't know how that, it doesn't feel fair for me to go there because I'm not sure how much that one is mine. But culturally, that is one that reminds me of the cross.
Yeah.
It is the state's method of taking care of threats against the state. And so, and how we have attached that to sports, and then even economically, how it's like now most people can't afford to go to Predators games. 3 years ago, you get a ticket pretty easily. But now that they've been to the Stanley Cup Finals, you see the class breakdown of who can go and whose team are they. And it's just fascinating to see all of that.
Which Nashville are they championing?
Right. And like, I don't know, but that's where my mind goes in the, like, what have we built to make ourselves feel safe that's actually And again, like, I can't tell you how much I enjoy it. I love sports. I love playing sports. I miss coaching. Like, it's not that sports, but it's how do we use those things? And is it glorious? Mm-hmm. You know, is it does a world championship, which is a pretty ambitious title, really last forever? You know, or is there something more beautiful? And that to me seems like one of our props. You know, like 17,000 people yelling at the opposing goalie, who's one of the 30 best people in the world at what he does. Uh-huh. And a goal gets by him.
Yeah.
And 17,000 people are encouraged to yell, "You suck."
Uh-huh.
The anger that we're not dealing with for that behavior to be so acceptable. Like, we are not dealing with something if we need to yell at one of the greatest people in the world, right? 30 people can do what he does. Yeah. And we need to yell at him. This, like, poor Finnish kid. Like,
right.
I don't know. Like, it's
scapegoating,
so misplaced.
In a way.
It is. It's scapegoating. The religious things that are happening there that make us feel comfort for a while.
We're incurably religious. So, to try on the answer no, I have this little poem by Marie Howe that is unsettling to me. The whole poem is called Calvary. She says, "Someone hanging clothes on a line between buildings, someone shaking out a rug from an open window, might have heard hammering one or two blocks away and thought little or nothing of it." So, to me, that's correlated to this answering no to beauty and the crucifixion, and even just like the word arbitrary is the first thing that comes to mind for me, and just like indifference, you know, and depicting humans didn't care, you know, or there are people who didn't care. And this wasn't an event broadcast to the entire world at its occurrence, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wonder what that stirs for you guys.
That's an avenue to something that came to my mind a few minutes ago that I didn't know how to bring it in, but that, you know, the electric chair comparison these days, like, you're going to find a group of people there to advocate for the person being electrocuted. That kind of punishment has advocacy now.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't advocates at the foot of the cross. There weren't people. There was no attempt at justice. And so I think of, like, the refugee who is told this boat is going to safety, and you get 100 people to pay for the spots on the boat that holds 50. And people show up and they've got to make a decision. Do I send my kids on this boat with strangers? Do we die here? Like, his death on some levels is more that kind of punishment from the state. Something about that resonates with his death as well, because there were no advocates, and that it was just mock justice in order to protect the institution and its false power. That's where that poem takes me.
And it's so mundane that this happens so much, so frequently. People are crucified and this woman is shaking out a rug and just hears it and, oh yeah, like that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Just another victim.
But then I guess I want to say too is, so is she right to perceive that as mundane? If it's Jesus being crucified or if it's anybody else being crucified, does the crucifixion need to be perceived as beautiful in order to be beautiful? You know,
that's a great question.
If a cross falls in a forest and nobody's there.
Well, my response would be Jesus' crucifixion advocates for everyone who has ever been crucified or executed or fallen victim to mock justice. And by virtue of his crucifixion, none of them are mundane.
I think that's right. I think that's part of what the poem does for me, you think, oh yeah, just another crucifixion. Oh no, wait, it was that crucifixion. Mm-hmm. Oh, then, you know, so that part of the beauty of the cross is holding up the significance of our mundane abuses of power and our mundane acts of terror against one another.
So in a really sort of roundabout way, that poem could ultimately be an advocate for another kind of beauty to the crucifixion. That might be kind of a hasty claim, but I think you could defend that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Well, I've got one more quote, and we'll go back to Moltmann for this to kind of wrap up. This is from his chapter called The Crucified God, from his book called The Crucified God.
From the album of the same name.
The self-titled. Title track of sorts. So he writes, God allows himself to be forced out. God suffers. God allows himself to be crucified and is crucified, and in this consummates his unconditional love that is so full of hope. The fact of this love can be contradicted. It can be crucified, but in crucifixion it finds its fulfillment and becomes love of the enemy. Thus its suffering proves to be stronger than hate. Its might is powerful in weakness and gains power over its enemies in grief, because it gives life even to its enemies and opens up the future to change. If one conceives of the Trinity as an event of love in the suffering and death of Jesus, and that is something which faith must do, then the Trinity is no self-contained group in heaven, but an eschatological process open for men on earth, which stems from the cross of Christ. There is no outside the gate with God, if God himself is the one who died outside the gate on Golgotha for those who are outside. So where does Moltmann see beauty in this description, do you think? And how does his perception of beauty defy our conventional wisdom of what is beautiful?
I think it's hard to try to add to that. I think he is the theologian that I hope is right. You read a lot, and I just hear him, and I just think, man, I hope he is the one who figured it out. What I hear in that is there is nowhere to hide, and there's no need to hide. But then I go to scripture, like, because we are hidden in Christ. And if your life is hidden in that one, like, play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The cross is the only place to hide.
Yeah. Maybe. And then the world gets to be what it actually is. So go play. Yeah. And then the
pressure's
joy,
off.
The joy comes. Mm-hmm. We don't have to hide from each other. We don't have to hide from God. Like, we are hidden, and all shall be well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I think it encourages us to look for beauty outside the gate. Right? That, or at least confronts our tendency to only look inside the gate for beauty. I think that's maybe one thing he's saying there with respect to beauty. And I think too, it reminds me of Schmemann again, that, you know, Schmemann says that the curse of death, the ugliness of death, the pain of death is separation from God. But if Jesus is God with us, who comes and stands with us in the place of death, then Jesus has emptied death of its death. Jesus has emptied death of its curse by filling it with God. And that's, you know, that's an answer that goes deeper than just a yes or a no, that requires us both to acknowledge the ugliness of death and the beauty of God's love for us.
Definitely. I'll go straight to Shmaimon, where he essentially says what you have said.
Where he paraphrases me.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm going to do, and we can end with this quote right here. He writes, "Christianity is not reconciliation with death. It is the revelation of death, and it reveals death because it is the revelation of life. Christ is this life, and only if Christ is life is death what Christianity proclaims it to be, namely the enemy to be destroyed and not a mystery to be explained. It is when Christ reveals life to us that we can hear the Christian message about death as the enemy of God. It is when life weeps at the grave of the friend, when it contemplates the horror of death, that the victory over death begins."
Thanks for joining us for the second half of my discussion with Danny Bryant, pastor of St. Mary of Bethany Anglican Parish, and Steve Guthrie, professor of religion and the arts at Belmont University. We began today with the idea that God made the crucifixion into a masterful turn of phrase, using a method of execution devised to convey human power to instead reveal human weakness. In that spirit, Danny referred to Frederick Buechner's book, Telling the Truth, where he describes the gospel as a great cosmic joke. A bit later, I said that surely some artist had depicted Jesus in an electric chair. In fact, London artist Paul Fryer has made a sculpture called Pieta that does just that. Later on, Steve mentioned St. Augustine's idea of sin as disordered loves. You can learn more about that in Confessions or on Christian Doctrine. I read a striking poem by Marie Howe called Calvary, and then we closed out our discussion with excerpts from Jürgen Moltmann's The Crucified God and Alexander Shmaimon's For the Life of the World.